Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, Religious Studies and Theology Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with David Wasserstein, Professor of History and Eugene Greener, Jr., Professor of Jewish Studies, about his recent book, Black Banners of ISIS, The Roots of the New Caliphate. David, thanks for being willing to do this interview.
Pleasure.
By virtue of its relatively young age, it's 3 years old or so, as well as its use of social media to gain recruits and advertise its acts and beliefs, the Islamic State, ISIS, seems a phenomenon of our century. You are, among other things, a scholar of medieval Islam. What does your perspective as an historian of Islam's earliest periods contribute to the copious and presumably growing literature about this 21st century organization that for some shouldn't even be considered Islamic?
I think a book like this, or a perspective like mine, is actually essential. It's not giving just an extra contribution. I think it's essential in providing the basis for understanding this sort of movement and the sort of things that this sort of movement is doing. ISIS, the Islamic State, is different from other Islamist revivalist movements, but it's not altogether different from them. If you take movements like Al-Qaeda, movements like the Taliban and other such movements, what you notice is that all of them are intent not just on getting people to be more religious, but on trying to make people more religious in a way that imitates, that reflects, that reenacts sometimes even, certainly that copies, the kind of Islam that existed before. They're trying to get people back to a purer form of Islam, and by purer they mean an idealized image of the original Islam of the Prophet Muhammad. ISIS, in a way, is simply the most extreme of such movements. And so a medievalist, such as myself, or a person who deals with medieval and early Islam, has the great advantage, or can offer the great benefit, I hope, of giving people an understanding of the kind of Islam that these people are trying to build, to create, to recreate.
Your book is entitled Black Banners of ISIS, The Roots of the New Caliphate. And we'll talk a bit more in various ways about the caliphate in a bit. But I wanted to ask about the black banners. What are they, and how does their appearance in the title relate to the arguments that you're making in this book?
They relate very closely to what I'm suggesting in this book. The black banners, which occur in my title, and I've noticed in other titles too, are an echo of the black banners which were the standard of one of the great revolutionary, messianic revolutionary movements of early Islam. In 750, just over 100 years, after the foundation of Islam, when the Abbasid dynasty rose up and overthrew the Umayyad dynasty, the first great dynasty, building dynasty of Islam. The Abbasids, who came from the east, from Iran, though they claimed to be of the family of the Prophet, carried banners which were entirely black. And terrifying as they were, of course, they helped to impress the message of the Abbasids on the people they were fighting against. But black banners remained the standard of the Abbasids for the centuries that they were in power, or that they reigned over the Islamic Caliphate. And the use of black banners today by ISIS and by related movements is meant very clearly to be an echo of that, and to recall to people today the message that the Abbasids themselves in 750 carried for Muslims.
Now, your book is exploring what IS thinks, what their ideology is, if I can attribute thinking to an organization. So what sources are available for discovering the Islamic State's ideology, and what are some of the limitations that you found with the sources that you used?
It's interesting that you say limitations. I'm not sure how many real limitations there are.
Mm-hmm.
There are two kinds of sources. Well, there are several kinds of sources. One kind is their actions. Mm-hmm. Actions don't tell us ideology directly, but they can reflect ideology. They may reflect ideology in fairly complex ways. For example, I think you may want to ask me about destruction of antiquities
mm-hmm.
Later on. But destruction of antiquities can reflect just nasty violence, but it can also be done with a very distinct purpose. And I think that the evidence shows that when ISIS destroyed antiquities, it was doing it with an ideological purpose, not simply out of unpleasantness. But we can get more and more direct information about ideology by looking at written sources, the sources that are put out by ISIS itself and by its followers. And when I say written sources, I don't in the 21st century mean just texts and books and articles. I mean, of course, also things like videos, the awful videos that we saw coming out of ISIS for the last 2-3 years are obviously part of that, and other kinds of audio, video, and generally speaking internet production all have a lot to teach us. But we also have other things. I think it's important to realize that ISIS, because it insists that it is simply trying to rebuild a past ideal vision of the Islamic State, also relies on past texts, texts composed very far in the past, as far back as the Quran itself. And those texts, in their way, also offer us hints and more about the ideology that ISIS espouses and tries to promote.
So can you go into a little bit of detail about some of the kinds of texts that they are particularly plumbing for their ideology?
Absolutely. The Quran is one. I mentioned that. It's very important to realize that the Quran means much more and much more literally and directly for people like the ISIS movement and its followers than the Bible means for most people today, whether they're Christians or Jews. The Bible is a holy text, and you know, we all respect it and love it, but we generally don't read it very much, and we certainly don't think that its prescriptions, for example, about stoning people or cutting people's hands off or an eye for an eye, are things that we should be implementing in our Western societies today. There are some exceptional people in our societies who do think that way, but they are very, very marginal. ISIS, on the other hand, like most Muslims in the world, takes the Quran very literally. I don't know how literally most Muslims take literally the idea of cutting people's hands off, but it is certainly the case that Muslims, far more than Christians, believe their holy writ, take the literal meaning of their holy writ to be true, and accept the fundamentalism accept the text that they have there as true in a much more fundamental sense than we do with our holy texts of Christianity and Judaism. So the Quran is very important for Muslims in general, and it's very important for that reason also for ISIS, who take it very literally. Beyond that, they are very interested in and take very literally the hadith, so-called traditions, which are short texts which tell us stories or anecdotes about the Prophet Muhammad, about things he did, about things he thought, how he behaved, how he practiced Islam, and so on. Many of these may be pious inventions, but they all claim to be true, at least the ones in the standard collections that we have. And one of them, at least, plays an extremely significant role in the ideology of ISIS, as I talk about at the end of the book, where I discuss their views about how the end is to come. That is, that their view there is built entirely on a hadith, a tradition attributed to the Prophet, and for them that is terrifically important. It's not one that most Muslims, I think, would take very seriously today, but it's one that they have picked up on and used to help themselves grow as a movement. And in the days we're living now, it's actually demonstrating for ISIS that their ideology is not altogether going to be correct, but that's a separate issue. Beyond that, they also are very interesting in the sense that, although they claim to be very concerned to rebuild the Islam of the first century, the Islam of the Prophet, the first century of Islam, and therefore to be concentrating on the Quran and texts associated with the Prophet, like the Hadith, they also, perhaps in common with most revivalist movements of Islam over the last 12, 13 centuries, have tended to accept other texts which are rather later. Islamic law, for example, is based on the Quran and Hadith and other such sources, but it's collected in a variety of texts written by, composed by a great number of scholars over the succeeding centuries and put together in texts which are reflective of at least four, sometimes five or six different schools of legal religious thinking over the centuries. Now, these, of course, are products of history, and history is a process of development and change, not just of continuity. So these legal texts reflect different things. They don't reflect only the sources. That's a fairly obvious remark, for an outsider at least, to be making. But for ISIS, as for many Muslims, but for ISIS, surprisingly, because of their insistence on going back to the sources, these texts, or the ones that they choose to use, do in fact reflect total continuity and not change and development. Mm. And that is something that's very interesting, and as many scholars will be working on this down the next few decades, I suspect, unless ISIS is totally forgotten. Mm. They also... No, I think I'll stop there.
Okay, well, I want to pick up on the selection process, and mm-hmm. I don't know mm-hmm. that your book goes into a lot of detail about this, but how would you characterize their sort of hermeneutical approach? I mean, how do they know to... Obviously, the Quran is going to be central to what they're doing, but mm-hmm. how do they... For example, you mention a very important text that they use to imagine the end, the apocalypse, but it's not a well-known text. How do you have a sense of how they arrive at selecting this text rather than this text? Or?
Yeah, I think there are two kinds of process involved here. One is that in common with many messianic movements and with many revivalist movements and many reformist movements in monotheistic faiths, generally speaking, over the last couple of thousand years, they tend to go back to the sources, or they tend to claim to go back to the sources for a very good reason. The sources are easily available to you and to me and to everybody, not just to the founders of a new faith or a new form of faith. Luther wanted people to go back to the Bible because, well, for one thing, because the Bible tended not to be available to people, and he thought it was the Bible. The Bible contained the message that God, Jesus, whoever had wanted mankind to have, not the endless volumes of hermeneutics that were produced by theologians and fathers of the church and people like that. Because for one thing, these were written in language which ordinary people couldn't understand, in a language that they couldn't understand, and in also in the types of language and the types of thinking that were way beyond normal. Normal people should have direct access. This is the thinking that's very common in revivalist movements. Normal people should have direct access to the sources, because it's the sources that have the message. Now, ISIS is no exception in this regard. It says normal people should be not necessarily reading the Quran. They should be, but that's not the issue here. The point they're making is that normal people should be behaving according to what the Quran says, not what endless interpreters with all their differences and quarrels and discussions and so on have been saying. It's what the sources tell us that should be our guiding light. And that, of course, is in a way something very common to fundamentalists and other kinds of simplifiers, which is essentially what fundamentalists are, simplifiers of religion. They try to avoid, to get away from, to discard all the complex sophistication of later thinking and discussion. Now, that is common to Christianity and Judaism. It's also common in Islam. Revivalist movements tend to do this. And in Islam... one of the interesting facts about ISIS is that in going back thus to the sources or claiming to go back thus to the sources, what it's doing also is trying to go back to other thinkers who have made similar claims in the past. Mm. One such thinker is a man called Ibn Hazm, who was a famous Andalusi, Spanish Islamic scholar in the 11th century, who set up his own legal school, which was based on the idea, or he joined his own himself to another legal school, which was, of which he was in a sense a second founder, if you like, which didn't last very long, partly because he said we have to go back to the sources, we have to take the literal meaning of the text and nothing else. And this has clear advantages and disadvantages, both from a religious point of view and from a social political point of view. There are ways you can run a society and ways you can't run a society. And sometimes the sources don't actually have a good answer. They may have a clear answer, but they may not always have a good answer for every problem that arises. And that's why that's where hermeneutics tends to come in and be necessary and very helpful. But in the case of ISIS, partly because, perhaps because it's very young, it hasn't got to the stage where it's got its own hermeneutics diverging from its understanding of the source, from its initial understanding of the sources. And so it's actually very close to the sources in many very distressing ways, throwing homosexuals off buildings and things like that. But in general, what I said is the case. It tends to go for a simplified, or what it sees, or what we can see as a simplified version of Islam shorn of the accretions of later centuries.
Mm-hmm. What you've been saying actually resonates with the question I'm about to ask. You argue against a number of perhaps commonly held views about IS. One has to do with the way in which many people understand its behavior towards its enemies, towards things like historically and culturally valuable antiquities. You write, quote, "We should not make the easy mistake of simply ascribing everything that IS does to a love of violence or a criminal indifference to rules. Here, as elsewhere, IS is following rules, not making them, obeying standards, not ignoring them, and trying through such actions not to reenact but to recreate a distant but ever-relevant past," unquote. So I wonder if you could give maybe a couple of examples. You mentioned actually the throwing homosexuals off buildings, but could you give a couple of examples of how IS's activities are explicable in the way that you're outlining here?
Yeah. First of all, I should say it's difficult to see how a movement like IS could have been successful for so long and attract so many supporters and followers, not just followers online, not just people who talk to each other stupidly in chat rooms in the West, but also people who come and fight and die from the West for ISIS, if it were simply another terrorist outfit or another gangster outfit like the Mafia or some criminal gang. It's an outfit with an ideology, with a message, and the message is one that resonates. It's one that resonates with many Muslims, not a great percentage of Muslims, but large numbers of young people particularly, who perhaps some of them have nothing else to do with their lives, are at a loss for something to do or want to impress their girlfriends or their boyfriends, but also people who have an ideological attraction to the message that is being propounded here. This is a message which is religious, and religion, whether we like it or not, has been a force for great good and great evil in world history. Some religions have been a force for more evil, and some religions have been a force for greater good, depending on time and place and circumstance. ISIS is an example of how it's been a force for a particular kind of Islamic revivalism. Revivalism has its own attraction for many people because it seems to draw people back to the real kind of faith. This is true in Christianity as it is in Islam, and we shouldn't forget that. But one of the differences that mark Islam off from Christianity is that the message there's a fundamental, deeper message of Islam is very different from the fundamental of Muhammad, is very different from the fundamental, deeper message of Jesus. Jesus had a very different career and a very different message and a very different way of propounding his message from Muhammad. Muhammad had a very successful career as a politician. It was that enabled his new faith to get off the ground and become what it later did become. And part of that is that he didn't behave like Francis of Assisi, perhaps of necessity, and part of it is that his holy text, the holy text that he gave to his followers, has messages which were very literally interpreted by some people at different times. And one of the messages is one of a severe punishment for evildoers. Another of the messages, perhaps more directly transmitted in Islam than in Christianity or Judaism, is the injunction that you should not tolerate polytheism. Mm. When Muhammad returned in triumph to Mecca towards the end of his life, one of the first things he did, we are told, is to go into the sacred enclosure of the Kaaba, the great shrine in Mecca, and physically, with his own hands, destroy the 360 idols that were there. 360 is, of course, a significant number. But he destroyed them. And, of course, the message there is that he did what Abraham had done before. And, as we know from the Old Testament and from the later stories about that, he had destroyed his father's idols. But in the case of Judaism and Christianity, the need, as it were, to do that is much less because there aren't any anymore. We don't have idols around, except that we do. And we have them in the form not of statues that people bow down to, or at least not in the form of statues that people think they're bowing down to. The Roman Catholics do, in fact, bow down in front of statues, though they don't think they're worshipping them, though one occasionally hears of them saying worshipping them. But Muslims can see idols all around them. If they look at places like Palmyra, if they look at places like Damascus, if they look at places like Cairo in Egypt, they can see idols of all sorts and kinds. Ancient statues, which are very often statues of gods, very often statues also of human beings. And for Muslims, such things are potentially dangerous. They carry with them the potential that, or in theory at least, that people might want to worship them, might want to bow down before them, might want to recognize them as something other than the one true and exclusive God. So when ISIS is going around destroying such statues and other antiquities of similar sort, it's doing something which isn't simply young people who like violence. Mm-hmm. It's young people who've got a message for us and for themselves. Thou shalt not tolerate this sort of thing. And that's the way they show that we should not tolerate that sort of thing. They are going ahead and destroying things of historical and cultural importance, as the Taliban did with the great Bamiyan Buddhas some years ago too. But we have to try to understand that not in terms simply of pointless violence. It's easy for politicians to dismiss this that way, but in fact there's more to it. When they do this, they are doing it with a kind of indifference to history and to cultural meaning. But we have to understand that history and cultural meaning don't carry the same resonance for people like the people of ISIS as they do for us. History for them is a sacred history, the sacred history of Islam and of their movement, which says, among other things, you have to get rid of idols. Cultural meaning for us is important not just in terms of tourism but also in terms of human mutual understanding and looking at our past and learning from it and benefiting from it, our past in the sense of the human past. But for ISIS, the cultural meaning embodied in things like great statues and idols from the past is meaning that is to be destroyed, not meaning that is to be preserved. So when they destroy, they're doing it with significance. They're not doing it simply out of a love of violence. Mm-hmm.
One of the other commonly held views about IS, or certainly a view that's been stated even by former presidents, and which you've so far in our conversation have suggested a response to, is the idea that IS is actually not an Islamic organization. There have been folks who kind of try to keep, who step around the notion that it is Islamic. And you're very strong about the inaccuracy and the unhelpfulness of that way of characterizing things. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's nonsense to say, as as you point out, two of your former presidents have done, that this is not Islamic. Of course it's Islamic. It's not at all helpful to say it's not. What I think the politicians are trying to do is, in fact, to be helpful and to be nice and to pretend that everything would be nice in the world if only we could get rid of ISIS. That's not true. The world is real, and we live in a real world, and it's got a lot of nastiness in it. And to say that this is not Islamic is just as helpful as to say that Christians who perform bad acts are not Christian. People who do, they are perhaps bad Christians, but they're not Christians. Muslim terrorists who act in the name of Islam are bad Muslims, perhaps, but they're no less Muslim for that. Now, the Islamic State, remember, this is what it's called, and it calls itself that, and it calls itself that for a reason. It's not simply trying to put one over on the rest of us. The Islamic State does claim to be Islamic, and it grows out of very solid and deeply rooted Islamic traditions, traditions which are wholly Islamic. We shouldn't forget that. This is not to say that Islam is bad. This is not to say that everything that comes out of Islam is bad. Far from it. On the contrary, there are as many good Muslims in the world as there are good Christians, if one can make such a judgmental claim at all about Christians or Muslims. But they are, but these are Muslims of a very particular stripe, and that stripe is a version of extremist Islam. It's also, not unrelated to that point, a version of messianic, revivalist, apocalyptic Islam. It's a kind of Islam which is trying to do something which is very different from what most Muslims are trying to do. Remember, most Christians and most Muslims and even some Jews think that the apocalypse, the end of time, the final judgment, whatever you want to call it, it's not round the corner. It's not happening tonight. If we did believe that, we wouldn't be saving for our pensions. We wouldn't be paying a mortgage. We'd be spending all our money and having a good time. But we certainly do not believe that Jesus is coming for a second time tomorrow. We do not believe, as Jews, that the Messiah is coming tomorrow, even though we say it in our prayers, that we do believe this. And Muslims also don't believe that. Nobody is so, I don't want to say so silly, but it's totally un-Christian, un-Jewish and un-Islamic to think that the Messiah or whatever is coming tomorrow. Our faith tells us this, we know that, but we have, like sensible people perhaps, we have put it off intellectually and in other ways till the end of time. And the end of time, it could be any time, but we don't know when. God doesn't vouchsafe such information to us, and he may have his own reasons for not telling us when it's going to happen precisely. But messianic movements, revivalist movements, movements that tell us repent for the end is nigh, and other such movements and preachers tell us that the end is really nigh, it's coming any time, any day, it could come tomorrow. This is very different, and it's something that we need to be aware of. So it's a different form of Islam or Islamic thinking from the kind of Islam that you will see in the Muslims here in Nashville. Mm. I have Muslims in my class, and they don't think that the apocalypse is coming tomorrow quite clearly. That's why they're studying. They're studying for exams. They're studying for a career. They're studying for a future. And this is true of most Muslims in the world. There are as many good Muslims as there are good people of any other type in the world. But this is not to say that all Muslims are the same Muslims, any more than all Christians are the same kind of Christians. The Pope is not the leader of all Christians, and but even among his followers, there are many different types of Roman Catholic. There are many different types of Christian. That's why there are so many different churches here in Nashville. On every corner, you'll see more than one church. If they were the same, they'd use one church. So too Muslims. They think differently. They have different ways of being Islamic. They have different types of Islam, and some are more Islamic, some are less Islamic, some are more religiously Islamic, some are less religiously Islamic. Some have different views of what Islam should be, and the ISIS people think that Islam should be a particular form of Islam, which is very different from that of most Muslims. Mm. But it's not different from that of all Muslims, nor is it different from that, substantially different from that of all Muslims in the past. As a revivalist movement, as a messianic apocalyptic movement, it has great similarities to other such movements in the past. One can point to a great number of them. There was one very famous one in North Africa and Spain in the 11th and 12th centuries. There was another one in the Sudan in the 19th and 20th centuries, one of the leading lights of intellectual and religious life in the Sudan to this day is a grandson or a great-grandson, I'm not sure how many generations removed, from the leader of such a movement in the Sudan at the end of the 19th century. Highly respected, but he's not as apocalyptically minded perhaps as his grandfather or great-grandfather.
So we're going to turn now from what have been sort of more general topics to specific things about that you take up in your... You take up all of this in your book, but we're going to turn to a few sections of your book with the hope that what we talk about will be representative of what you're doing in the book as a whole. And well, hopefully we'll just encourage the listeners to actually read the entire book to get all of the details. So the first example, which was actually quite intriguing to me when I read it, was your discussion of the administrative and financial aspects of the Islamic State. Because is that something that you... At least I don't typically think about. When I think about the Islamic State, I'm not thinking about how they're managing their area. So what do we learn about the Islamic State from considering the way that it runs its caliphate? And what are some of the assumptions, particularly from the news media, that have obscured clear knowledge of these aspects of the organization?
I think the main assumption that has obscured our understanding has been the presentation, the pretty widespread presentation by politicians and the media of ISIS as simply a group of terrorists, as simply a group of people who are out to bomb and kill and enslave and destroy as much as they can, and do so particularly against people from the West, like Americans and French and Belgians and British and people like that. Whereas, in fact, although the people in the West, peoples in the West, countries in the West are or were in the targets of ISIS, the main targets of ISIS propaganda, the main targets of ISIS action have been, in fact, other Muslims. What they're intent on is building an Islamic society, building an Islamic state, building an Islamic world. And to build the world, of course, they have to have us in their sights as well. But that's further down the road. What they want to do is build an Islamic state in order to bring on the apocalypse, the Islamic apocalypse. The way they see it, the Islamic apocalypse can come only when there's an Islamic state, which is two things. It's a state ruled by Islam, and it's a state dominated by Islamic behavior and mores. And this means that you have to have a state. First, you can't have Islamic mores in a state unless you have the state. And so they need to build a state. And a state, again, contrary to what the media try to tell us, is something that has to be run and administered. And in this sense, calling it a caliphate on the pattern of early Islamic history too, what they're trying to do is both prepare for the apocalypse and do it in terms of how early Islam acted or was acted out. In the form of a state. And that means having a state that runs itself. Now, a state is not simply an object of chaos. It's not simply a matter of despoiling people, particularly women of other faiths, of the jewels that they're wearing and of the golden bracelets on their arms. It's a question of running a state, providing services. A state is a two-way process. It's not simply an operation of extraction of wealth from defeated people. It's also a question, because you want to maintain the state, and you want the state to be maintained until the apocalypse comes, and you want people to behave in a particular way, it's a matter of providing services for them. Such services as, for example, hospitals, such services as schools and education, such services as universities. These may not operate in the way that they operate, say, in Nashville, or in London, or in Paris, or in Peru, but they are services that can operate in a state dominated by Islam. They may separate the sexes. There are other things that they may do, but they can do it. And they did do it. They didn't do it perhaps quite as well as we might have hoped, but they, or expected even, but they did do it. And one of the things they did was, of course, to raise money. Now, it was very difficult for them to raise money, to raise funds, because of the situation in which they found themselves. But they raised dramatic amounts of money, perhaps not as dramatic as the media portrayed, but as I argue in the book. Mm-hmm. But they did raise funds. And they administered. We have a surprising number of bits of evidence of their administrative skills. I don't say these skills were that great, but they did have administrative skills. They produced birth certificates, they produced high school certificates and syllabi for university study, they produced syllabus texts for schools, they produced examinations and examination timetables for students, both in schools and in universities. They produced all kinds of documents. They produced official receipts, they produced the equivalent of internal passports, driving licenses, all kinds of things which demand more than simply a person with a pen and a piece of paper to produce and to use. Remember, people don't produce documents simply to be thrown away. They produce them for use. They are for use within a defined area. A driving license from the state of Tennessee is valid here because it's issued by the state of Tennessee and has meaning in the state of Tennessee. It has meaning beyond that for other reasons. But it's an organizational structure that dominates a particular area that determines the meaning of a particular document. And ISIS was able to do that. Beyond that, it was able to raise money. It raised money partly by plunder and theft, as we know. It raised money, it is said to have raised large amounts of money from stealing and selling antiquities. I argue in the book that any such sums were relatively small, and I offer good reasons for thinking that. They made a lot of money, it seems, from selling oil. And here I agree that they may have made what are in human terms, individual human terms, fairly large sums, but I'm again not convinced that these were very, very large. The amounts that the media proclaim seem to me to be grossly exaggerated. Mm. It's in the interest of the media to do that. But they did certainly sell large amounts of oil, probably at very knockdown prices, for obvious reasons, because of black market and similar types of selling techniques that they had to employ. But they were doing it, and they had the organizational infrastructure, not just of a terrorist gang, again, but of something akin to a state on the move, if you like, that made it possible for them to do things like that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned treatment of women, and you have a section, a chapter of the book on women, how women exist in the Islamic State, women who've aligned themselves with the Islamic State. And you add some texture to the stories of these people by using, I think, a broader range of sources than what we might find just from reading newspaper articles. What role do women play in IS, and how do these roles serve both the pragmatic and theological goals of the organization?
The answer to that has changed in recent weeks, partly because of the setback that ISIS has suffered. Mm. But let me begin at the beginning. I think it's fair to say that ISIS saw women as full participants in their movement, but of a second rank. Mm. Just as one can be a supporter of a political movement and still be a full participant in it without being a leader, so ISIS saw women as potential full supporters and members of their movement without allowing them to have full rank. For example, the caliph is a man, if he's still alive, and his electoral council is composed entirely of men. This does not mean that women are disregarded. I think in the West, partly because of the women's movement in the last 50 years of Western history, we tend to think that women should be allowed and should be able to fill any role in society that men do. That's a function of our own recent history. But there are Christians and there are Jews who think that women can do that, be full members of their society, without nevertheless being allowed to fill any role. ultra-Orthodox Jews take that view. So do ultra-Orthodox Jewesses, by the way. And the same is true of many Christian men and women. If we look at the evangelical movement in the United States today, it is very interesting to note how many members of that movement are, in fact, of the second sex. Look, too, at the voters for the current president of the United States of America. It's very, very interesting how many women voted for him, given his views on women. Now, if you look at ISIS, much the same is true. Women are full members, but they are not necessarily, therefore, active in at all levels and in all roles in the organization and in the movement. But they have done a great deal, and they do what they see, like Orthodox women in Judaism, ultra-Orthodox women in Judaism, or evangelical women in Christianity. They fulfill very happily, we are led to believe at least, the roles that are assigned to them by the tradition of which they are fully part. And this means that, as one happy jihadist woman wrote in her diary, I am cooking for the jihadis. Jihadis will eat the food that I am cooking. Well, this made her very happy, I'm sure. But women do fill roles, and many of these roles are what we might regard in the West today as second level or secondary roles. They act as cooks, they act as messengers, they act as nurses rather than doctors, and so on. Although in the case of doctors and nurses, there are other complications because of the separation of the sexes. And they but they have generally been rejected or not allowed to take part in fighting. And this is the one aspect that I mentioned earlier has changed in the last few weeks. In recent weeks, it is reported that ISIS has allowed or requested or sought to allow women to be suicide fighters, suicide bombers, drivers of suicide car bombs, for example. And this reflects perhaps, very probably, a decline in the number of volunteers for this among men. Whether it will have any effect is another matter, of course, entirely. But it does seem to suggest that pragmatism here, as in other areas, can trump ideology. Ideology in ISIS, as in other movements, is not something that is rigid. It is something that is very often flexible in reaction to circumstance. And circumstance is dealing ISIS heavy blows at the moment. And suicide bombs, one very effective mode of attack for ISIS, are something that need volunteers, and the volunteers may not be coming from men anymore, or not sufficiently. So that is how we would explain the recourse to women. It doesn't mean that the ideology is changing, it simply means that they're being more pragmatic.
Scholars have often remarked on the relative tolerance Islam has historically shown, particularly towards Jews and Christians who've lived in Muslim-dominated areas. How has, since we begin to talk about ISIS in sort of a past tense way, how has ISIS regarded other religious traditions that have been under its control in Iraq and Syria, and what are the sources of these, the treatment that they're, that and the beliefs that ISIS holds towards other faiths?
I think the first thing to note here is that tolerance, the word tolerance that we use about medieval Islam, is perhaps a misnomer. Tolerance suggests that other truths can be. Other truths can be true for other people, they can be believed by other people, they can be accepted by other people, and therefore they should be accepted, or their existence should be accepted by us. I'm not sure that medieval Islam, classical Islam, had people who really thought that way. I'm not sure that tolerance is the word we would use. I think there are other ways of labeling it, other ways of describing how Islam and Muslims related to followers of other faiths and to other faiths in themselves. Certainly, the fate of Christianity and Judaism under Islam, under Islamic rule, and of Christians and Jews, was less unfavorable than the fate of non-Christians or of Christians of the wrong stripe under Christian rule over most of the last 14 centuries, or the last 19 centuries, 20 centuries in the case of Christianity. What this means, though, in the case of ISIS, is that when they came upon populations, as they did, large populations of non-Muslims or Muslims of the wrong stripe in the territories that they conquered over the last 3 or 4 years, their reactions to them, their ways of reacting to them, were not those of tolerance in the modern 20th century Western sense, nor in terms actually of the broad trend of medieval classical and medieval Islamic behavior. They saw Islam, their kind of Islam, as the only true message, the only true understanding of God's message to mankind, to humankind. And they believed, therefore, that people who did not follow their brand of Islam, whether they were Muslims or not, were not fit to survive. However, this was realized in different forms. Mm. If the people involved were Muslims or claimed to be Muslims, then they were clearly infidels. And infidels had really only one option, and that is to die. Mm. They didn't offer Shiites, for example, in Iraq, much opportunity to become Sunni Muslims, as we saw when they murdered large numbers of Shiite soldiers of the Iraqi army and just dumped them in the Euphrates to drift down rotting to Baghdad and horrify the populace, because they were infidels, they were heretics, people who actually had the truth and rejected it. They distorted it and rejected it. Yazidis, whom they treated abominably in Mount Sinjar, were infidels of a different stripe. They were infidels who didn't have Islam. They were simply infidels, and they seem, you know, so particularly if you take a simplistic view of idolatry and all the rest of it, they seem to be idol worshippers and people who had polytheistic ideas and so on, and therefore they had no right to live, and they could be offered the opportunity to convert to Islam, and some of them were perhaps, but generally speaking, they were treated very badly too. Their women and children, on the other hand, in accordance with an age-old practice, both in Islam and out of Islam, were treated as spoils of war. Mm. They could be treated as slaves, they could be enslaved, they could be bought and sold as slaves or as women to be raped and sometimes married, but they were not treated well. But that leaves Christians and Jews. Jews we can forget about because, fortunately for them, there were no Jews in the territories conquered by the Islamic State. But Christians, on the other hand, were in a very different case, because Mosul, which was their second city, and Raqqa, which is in Syria, both contained large numbers of Christians. Raqqa, because it's in Syria, which is, to use the normal word, a mosaic of different faiths and remnants of many different faiths and sects from all through history, and Mosul because it is in an area of Iraq which traditionally has retained very large numbers of Christians and also is part of an area which it was a great mosaic of different faiths and their followers. Also, Mosul is one of the oldest centers of Christianity. We tend to forget that Christianity didn't come west from Palestine in the first century and second century after Jesus. It's not a European faith originally, it's an Asian faith. Palestine is in Asia, and it moved east, and it moved all the way deep into Central Asia and even into China before Islam came along, and then Islam came along and pushed it back. But in the case of northern Iraq and Syria and in Mosul, large numbers of Christians survived to this day. They survived until the time of Saddam Hussein. Mm. And when ISIS arrived in Mosul, it found them. And it faced the situation, it faced the problem, the dilemma that conquerors, Islamic conquerors, Muslim conquerors faced when they got there 14 centuries ago. Here are huge numbers of Christians. They know the truth, but they don't want to know the truth. They know the truth that Muhammad is the messenger of the one God, but they think that Jesus is his last messenger, as it were. And they are not interested in Muhammad. Well, we could kill them all, or we could not kill them all. We can't kill them all. To put this in very simple terms, mm-hmm. We can't kill them all because there are an awful lot of them. But ISIS had a solution which the early Muslims didn't have. Or rather, they had the solution that the early Muslims found. That was to come to an arrangement with them, to come to an arrangement with them that actually left them in a position of subordination to Islam and actively, but not too actively, perhaps encouraged them to think about the advantages of becoming a Muslim, seeing the light of Islam and the truth of Islam and accepting it perhaps further down the line. So what they did was impose on the Christians of Raqqa and of Mosul, and perhaps we don't know fully yet, but perhaps also of other areas too, a so-called pact or an arrangement modelled after the so-called Pact of Omar, which is a text probably of the 9th or 10th century, but one that claims to be of the 7th or 8th century, which lays down the obligations and the rights of Christians living under Muslim rule. It allows them, for example, to retain their faith. It allows them to pray in their churches, but not too loudly. It forbids them, for example, to ring church bells. You don't see many church bells in the Middle East, but because they're banned, because church bells can spread the message of Christianity. You will find Christians using clappers, which are not heard outside the churches. They can bury their dead, which is an important feature of tolerance, permission to survive for minority groups, Jews and Christians, in all situations. And they can do other things as Christians. But in the case of these Christians, they must pay a special tax as members of such a minority faith in return for the right to subsist as Christians under Islamic rule. And we have, to go back to your question about administration, we even have paper evidence of Christians paying this tax, which is a tax that harks back to a similar tax paid by Christians and Jews under Islamic rule over the last 14 centuries.
As we've said a number of times already, the Islamic State has fallen on hard times, at least as far as its dreams for a caliphate in Iraq and Syria are concerned. But there are branches of the organization in other parts of the world, including in northern Africa. You have argued, and in this interview you've talked a bit about the Islamic State's ambitions, which rest on the establishment of a caliphate as the prerequisite for the occurrence of an apocalypse. So assuming that the Islamic State doesn't resurrect its caliphate anytime soon, how do they adjust their ideology to the facts on the ground, especially if that ground is somewhere other than Iraq and Syria?
That's a very important question, I think, because it goes to the root of the issue. What is going to happen to ISIS now? We don't know if the caliph is still alive. He might be alive, he might be dead, he might be lying injured somewhere. And the truth is, it doesn't matter in the slightest. We may never know what has happened to him. It doesn't matter in the slightest because ISIS has lost its territorial base in the Middle East. It has lost Raqqa. It has lost 98% probably of the territory it controlled in Syria and Iraq. And that's only today. In the next few weeks, it will probably lose all semblance of any territorial control in the Middle East. And what that means, having lost its territory, having lost its capital, having lost probably its caliph, because he's certainly not around, what that means is, I believe, that ISIS is finished. ISIS is over. The ISIS ideology is gone. Now, you mentioned branches in various countries in the world, like in the Philippines or Afghanistan or in North Africa. That's all true, but except for the use of the word branches, I think. I think I would rather use the word franchise or affiliates. I think these are Islamist terrorist outfits, using terrorism, much the way ISIS did, but they weren't part of a single organizational structure, except in the very, very loosest of senses. These are organizations like Boko Haram, also in Nigeria, which saw the advantage to themselves, saw a great potential advantage to themselves in taking on loyalty and obedience, at least so-called obedience, to the Islamic Caliphate of ISIS, because it gave them some sort of aura among potential followers in their own areas. It gave them an ideology which went beyond anything that they had themselves. And and gave ISIS that form of recognition. But it's not something that made them, in any real sense, fully part of the Islamic State. And my belief at the moment is that the reality could change. But it seems to me at the moment that what is happening with ISIS is that it is dying at home, and the terrorist outfits outside will tend to fall away and resurrect themselves, if anything, as the sorts of organization or movement that they were before. So that I don't think the ideology of ISIS is something that's going necessarily to survive very long.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, David, for this conversation. It's been the book and the conversation have been quite illuminating. So thank you very much. Again, I've been talking with David Wasserstein, professor of history and Eugene Greener, Jr., professor of Jewish studies, about his recent book, Black Banners of ISIS, The Roots of the New Caliphate, published by Yale University Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.